This is the podcast for Monday, February 11th, 2013, Theories of Knowledge. And we're starting out with a video about the philosopher Immanuel Kant. So settle down, everybody. Pay attention. Exciting stuff coming.
Awoke the genius of the 18th century Prussian philosopher Immanuel Kant.
This is important, huh?
Hume's attack on the inductive reasoning awoke the genius of the 18th century Prussian philosopher Immanuel Kant. Kant, roused from his dogmatic slumbers, launched himself on a program to integrate the subjectivity inherent in Hume's view with a theory that could incorporate the unknowability of the world in itself. Kant sought to close the gap between the rationalist and empiricist traditions by synthesizing them into a single, coherent thesis.
Kant certainly saw himself as coming at a pivotal position, and he recognized defects in both the rationalist and the empiricist traditions, indeed, to some extent. He defined those two traditions in order to explain the defects in both and to synthesize what was true in the two of them, to use one of his own favorite words.
With one bold stroke, Kant turned the tables on Hume, asserting that while we can't derive causality from experience, the fact that we have such a mental framework is vitally important. The fact is, we all share these categories of experience. So while causality may not exist out there in the world, what matters is that we all still experience the world in the same way. The mind makes the world, not the other way around.
Kant prided himself on what he called the Copernican revolution in philosophy, the idea that actually the mind structures the way reality can appear to us, and then in a sense, reality has to conform to the laws of the mind rather than the mind trying to discover what laws of reality are, which are completely external to it. Kant put the mind in a different relation to reality than any of his predecessors. His predecessors had thought of the mind as a passive observer of reality and had sort of looked around for some kind of guarantee that it was a good passive observer of reality.
Kant was a master at drawing distinctions. One pre-existing distinction he affirmed was between a priori judgments, which are based on reason, and a posteriori judgments based on experience. A priori judgments, such as 2 plus 2 equals 4, are necessarily true, while a posteriori judgments, this car is red or today it is raining, are contingent, forever tied to the circumstances of experience. Kant made a further crucial distinction between analytic and synthetic judgments. Analytic judgments take the form of sentences that have predicates which are wholly contained in their subjects, such as, all bachelors are unmarried. Synthetic judgments have predicates that are distinct from their subjects. Kant used the example, all bodies are heavy. Thus, they add something that we didn't already know to the subject. Then, in a sharp break with his predecessors, Kant proposed we need to consider all four possible kinds of judgment, analytic a posteriori, synthetic a posteriori, analytic a priori, and synthetic a priori. Since all a posteriori judgments are synthetic, an analytic a posteriori judgment is not a real possibility. Further, he asserted that synthetic a priori judgments not only are possible, but in fact serve as the foundation for mathematics and natural science.
Kant's innovation was, in technical terms, was to think that there was such a thing, he could demonstrate there to be such a thing as synthetic, but a priori knowledge. That is, knowledge that goes beyond the concepts involved, or knowledge, more precisely, knowledge that a predicate applies to an object which is not already implied by the subject concept, but which yet can be known to be true universally and necessarily, and therefore must somehow be known to be true independently of experience.
That a straight line between two points is the shortest is a synthetic proposition. For my concept of straight contains no notion of quantity, but only of quality. The concept of shortest is thus wholly an addition, and it cannot be derived by any analysis from the concept of a straight line. Intuition must, therefore, lend its aid here, by means of which alone is this synthesis possible.
Kant took his radical notion of a priori synthetic judgments and applied it to aesthetics, ethics, and political philosophy. In moral philosophy, he put forth...
We don't need to know about Kant's ethics. Let me just...
So he basically tries to merge the two together?
Right. So it's a... Kant loves this word synthesis. The lights.
Well, how is he merging the two together if he's taking a completely different approach on the mind than both predecessors who came up with empiricism and rationalism?
Well, I would say he's not. In one way, he's taking a different approach, but it's not completely different. Think about like Locke's concept of primary and secondary qualities. So somebody, just to as a refresher, what's Locke's distinction between primary and secondary qualities? What's the difference between those two kinds of qualities?
Primary quality, it describes a quality of an object, and a secondary quality is how that object kind of like affects you.
Uh-huh. Good. So a primary quality is a quality out there in the object. A secondary quality has to do with the way we perceive that object. What it, now, he puts it as you know, what it does to us. But you can think about it as being the way we perceive an object as opposed to the way an object really is. Now, when you come to Kant, Kant says it's all secondary qualities. That we never perceive reality as it is in itself. There's only reality as we perceive it. Now, you might think, well, I thought he was going against Hume. I thought he wasn't a skeptic like Hume was. I thought he was moving us back more in a realist position. Well, Kant does a sort of trick where he says, well, we can never know reality in itself, but we can know how we experience it. So let's restrict ourselves to talking about the world as we experience it. Understand how the way we experience it works, and we'll call that knowledge.
Does he think there is a reality?
Yeah, he does. So Kant says you know through reason that there's a world which is external to your mind. He thinks that's a priori, that there's an objective world. So we know that through pure reason. But we can never know the objective world, because to perceive means to perceive through some sensory organ. It also means to conceive the world in a certain way based on the structures of a mind. And the mind is not a passive receptor of data. The mind is active in combining all the data from the senses. And the way the mind combines that data and interprets it and analyzes it and reconstructs it is actually adding to our experience. It's not just sort of taking stuff that's there and rearranging it. It's actually producing our experience actively. And it's adding stuff that's not there. Just like, and it's interpreting things that aren't out there in the world. So Kant says, there is an objective world, we can never know it. But we can know the way that world appears to us and make a lot of generalizations about it. And we're going to call that knowledge. So we'll have a sort of a science of appearances. So we know what happens in the world of appearances. We can make a generalization about them. We know the world of appearances represents a real world out there. But since we can never know that real world out there, we'll stick with our science of appearances, and we'll call that knowledge. So that's
he only believes in secondary qualities.
Yeah, he would say that the way we perceive the world is like Locke says we perceive secondary qualities. In other words, think about secondary qualities as a model for the way we perceive the world. Locke wants to say you perceive shape and size. The shape and size is out there in the object. You're perceiving it through the senses as it is out there in the world. But he says colors and smells and tastes are different. There, you're getting data from the senses, but your senses are actually putting something in your experience that isn't there in reality. You're getting these red sensations. The red sensations are coming from you. They're not coming from the object. But they're coming from you in response to some quality in the object. So this color is a sort of this weird combo property in that there really is something out there, namely the way the object bounces light waves into your eyes, that cause you to have that experience. But also the fact that you have that particular experience of redness, that's coming from you. That's coming from the cones in your eyes. That's coming from the way your eyes work. And so the redness isn't really out there in the world. It's something that your eyes create and your mind creates in response to something that's out there in the world. Something else that's out there in the world. Yeah.
So since Kant says that we can't fully see reality as it is, and think that all the experiences that we are accepting as knowledge are false or just second qualities, exactly how you see it.
He would say that even though we can't know reality itself, we can still know something about reality based on our experience. In other words, he would, I think, agree with Locke that we can't imagine the world existing without there being substances or objects out there in the world. But he agrees with Hume that we can never know those objects. So it's... Let me just...
It'll help it. Give me some terms there.
And phenomena.
So noumena is the world in itself. Or actually, I'll put this, the world, literally this means the thing in itself. The world as it is in reality, uninterpreted by human perception and conception. Now, as it is in itself. And then there's phenomena, which is the thing as such, or the world as humanly experienced. And most philosophers would say, okay, well, that's like the difference between appearance and reality. And philosophers are all about getting to the reality, getting around the appearance and getting to the reality. And
that Kant doesn't believe he believes in reality, but he doesn't believe that we can know it.
Right, so there is a real world out there. We just can never know it. I think, Hume has that view too. It's interesting, if you look at Hume and Kant actually have more in common than you would think. It's just their emphasis, I suppose. Hume would say, well, we can never know anything about the real world, so just throw up your hands and say that's it is what it is. And and Hume makes this distinction between when you put on your philosopher's hat, you say, oh, well, really, I can't prove there's cause and effect. I don't know if the sun's going to rise tomorrow. But when you take off your philosopher's hat and walk out in the street and mix with the masses, you believe the sun's going to come up tomorrow like everybody else does. And so he makes this distinction between what's really knowable versus how you live your life. And he would say that even though you can't prove it, you have, I suppose, a kind of a faith that the world is a certain way. And he says that's part of human nature, that you can't shake that, that you are formed through custom and habit to think in terms of cause and effect, to think there's an objective world independent of your mind, and so on. You just don't have any reason to think that's true. You can't prove it. There's no logical argument you can give that will show that it's true. But because you're a human being, you can't not think the world's that way. You might do it for a little while, like in your study, as you think logically, you think, oh, this doesn't make any sense, there's no way to prove it. But then, in the rest of your life, you just assume that it's true, because you can't live your life otherwise. Now, Kant wants to sort of dial that back and say, no, you can have a kind of a philosophical view of the world without being a complete skeptic and saying we can't know everything. What you need to do is lower the bar of knowledge. And you can have a kind of a science of appearances, a science of phenomena. And so Kant would say you can know there is an objective world. We experience it, and we experience this world through human categories in which but help create our experience. So again, it's like secondary quality. Secondary quality like color. Now, it's not as if there's nothing out there in the world that's causing you to see red. There is something out there that's causing you to see red. But it's also not the case that the red's totally coming from your mind either. You do have cones in your eye, but without an object that's bouncing that certain wavelength of light into your eyes, you're not going to have the red sensation. So it's a combination of stuff that are out there in the world affecting you and the way you are affected by it as a human being. It's a sort of two. So there's the external world affecting you in a certain way, and then there's also the way you are affected by it. As a human being. And it's both these things. Now Hume wants to say you can never know there's a real world and it's all just these ideas bouncing around. Kant says that view is absurd. But he also says, the opposite view of somebody like Descartes is also wrong, that you can't know things through pure reason either. All concepts show you about is sort of more concepts. And so he thinks Descartes' wrong, but he doesn't like the skeptical conclusions of Hume either and thinks that the conclusions are absurd. He says we know that there's a real world out there, that there's something like cause and effect, that we have a mind, all those things that Hume denies. So he wants to hold on to sort of common sense ideas. There's a real world, I have a mind, and there's such thing as cause and effect, science is possible, and so on. But he also doesn't want to sort of go back to Descartes, and because he realizes rationalism doesn't work either. So he kind of tries to combine both both rationalism and empiricism in this new view, which he calls transcendental idealism. That's his fancy name for it. And basically, this idea that there's a world beyond us which causes us to have certain experiences. And those experiences are formed by the way our minds work and by the way our perceptual equipment works. Yeah.
And so how does this is it different than relativism? Because it seems like it's kind of relative by the way you perceive it and the way you're affected by mm-hmm. it. So
it does start to sound sort of relativistic now, right? Because now we're saying, well, there's an objective world out there, but the way we perceive it is colored by our status as human beings. This makes a lot of people uneasy. This is why a lot of some of the modern analytic philosophers think that Kant went in the wrong direction here. And Kant sort of kicks off a whole school of German philosophy. So if you have Kant here, you get so-called postmodern philosophy, which is relativistic, sometimes it's called continental because it's continental philosophy, because it's from the continent of Europe as opposed to that little island out there, Britain, where you get the analytic tradition. Which kept the sort of realist and scientific, scientific worldview in it. The analytic tradition assumes, I think, more. It takes a non-relativist turn. Those are Britain and America. And so, both these people claim Kant as sort of their intellectual forefather. But the postmodernists pick up on this idea that we can never know reality itself, and all we have is the science of appearances. Oops, I put this down here. There. Yeah.
Does Kant ever fully explain why he thinks we can't completely know reality? I mean, I think with some other philosophies, it might be easier for me just to understand why they're completely shutting it out. But with Kant, he's saying we can know a little bit, but not everything. And does he just think it's too good to be true that we can know everything, or it's that's too easy, or does he give a no reason for not? It kind of seems like he's cutting off halfway through getting to reality.
Yeah, he gives some arguments. The basic argument is you have an object out here, and then you have your view, right? So it's sort of like you think about the representationism versus realism. Object, and then here's the perceiver. So you have you're looking at the object, but you're not really seeing the object. What's happening is there's some light source here, right? And it's light rays are bouncing off there and going into your eye, and then it's taking an image and putting it upside down in your retina, and then your mind sort of straightens it out, and it creates nerve and pulses, and they go down your optic nerve, and somehow it creates this idea in your mind of the object out there. And it's not just that, but you might get some touch sensations from your hands. You might get sound waves coming off the thing. There's vibrations in the air. So there's all these senses are data streams that are coming into your mind, and your mind is sort of putting them together. And the big question is, how do you know that the way your mind puts things together matches the object out there in the world? Well, you have to sort of, you know, pop out of yourself, right? And be like a disembodied consciousness. But then, as a disembodied consciousness, how are you going to perceive anything if you don't have any senses? So, to perceive something is to perceive something through sensation. But sensation never gives you the object in itself. It only gives you the object as it's perceived through that set of senses. Think about bats actually have vision. But think about a bat sonar. I can never know what it is to experience an object through a bat sonar. Or to have a sonar experience. But, you know, bats are able to locate objects and navigate around through them. They have a sensation. I can never know what it is. But it's not as if I've got, like, normal sensations that tell me about the world, and the bat has this weird sonar thing. The sonar thing is just another way of experiencing the world. But it's not any better or worse than mine, but it's different. And so the bat's experience is going to be different than my experience. So there's always this problem of, how do I know my experiences represent the world when there's no way to get outside of myself to see whether my experiences are accurately depict the world or not? You see what I mean? So that's the skeptical problem. Is there's no way for me to jump out of my skin and look at me and look at my situation and look at my perceptions and the way I'll work, the way my brain analyzes the information, and then look at the real world and see that the two things match up. So that's in general what Kant's thinking. That you can never know the world unperceived or unanalyzed, because your brain works a certain way and thinks about the world in certain terms, in addition to your perceptual equipment working a certain way.
So does he ever say that he follows rationalism in that sense?
Well, I think he follows rationalism in the...
representationalism.
So, I think Kant says that you can never know whether the idea in your mind corresponds with reality, because reality itself is unknowable. But the idea in your mind corresponds to something. You just can never know what it actually is. And you can know that, you know, human beings with standard perceptual equipment and standard brains think about the world in certain ways and perceive the world in certain ways. And so what you should do is, when you're doing science, just take that as a standard. Give up the philosopher's dream of knowing reality unperceived, because that's nonsense. It doesn't make any sense. It's impossible. So that's Kant's basic view, this distinction between noumen and phenomena. So some people, like in particular the philosopher Ayn Rand, thought Kant was the most destructive philosopher of all time. He was the worst philosopher ever, because he takes us away from this idea of trying to understand the objective world and sort of gives you this idea that reality is always subjective. And he spawned this whole postmodern philosophy term, where you get people like Hegel and Husserl and Schopenhauer and all these guys, these idealists, that want to say that reality is sort of constructed by the mind. And then you get, this ends up with, you know, an absurdity where you have, professors at the U, I don't know if they're still kicking around, but I saw one time someone was talking about the phallocentric worldview, and basically saying that science was a form of male oppression of nature. And that science and the industrial society was a way of raping Mother Nature and raping and dominating Mother Nature, and it was all basically a big power trip, and it was an attempt by men to show their virility and dominating nature, instead of, like, you know, trying to understand the world the way it is, or trying to understand and control nation. Or control nature for human welfare. Maybe you've heard, like, people say that, you know, everything, they politicize everything. even like a scientific discovery always has some hidden political agenda, and this idea that there's no truth, there's just like the truth of the authorities or the power structure, and all that sort of started out with Kant. Now Kant wouldn't agree with any of that stuff, but he kind of gets his foot in the door, right, to all this sort of nonsense you might hear about, you know, post-structuralism and deconstruction and all this crazy stuff that often it's taught in the literature department, but sometimes you see it crop up in philosophy. There's this philosopher, I'll just write some of these.
Well, my friend referred to Hegel, Heidegger.
If you're like bored on a lazy Saturday afternoon and thinking about a nap, just read a few pages of these guys. And you're like, oh, Kant, David Hume, Berkeley, whatever it was it Berkeley? It was Berkeley, wasn't it? Even though they named the university after him. But then you come back from that and you say, well, wait a minute. These guys, they're like, it's just like, there's words, but I there's no meaning. And those guys were clear. Like, I remember reading Berkeley, I thought he was insane, but at least I understood what he was saying. These people, they're like just stringing words together without any meaning. So Hegel, Heidegger, Husserl, the three H's. Husserl. And then, you know, what happens when you go towards irrationalism usually ends in something worse like Marxism. So, you know, dialectical materialism from Karl Marx, he's basically the heir of Hegel and Schopenhauer and these other German philosophers. He called it dialectical materialism. And you got to come straight out of Hegel with his thesis and antithesis and synthesis. But it's all this sort of idealistic philosophy all stems from Kant. So I think Ayn Rand might have had a point that once you sort of open the door and try to say that reality is sort of relativistic, then you end up here. Now, I think Kant would say, I'm not saying it's all relative. What I'm saying is that it's not all, it's not direct realism. So, I mean, you might see Kant as sort of being anti-direct realism. He's saying, no, there is an objective world, it is a certain way, but as a human being, I can never know reality in itself. But that doesn't mean I can't know anything. I can know a lot about the world as I experience it. And I know the reason I experience the world as I do is because of the way the real world works. But since I don't have direct access to the real world, I'm going to stick with the way I experience the world as a human being. And we're going to do science that way. And we're going to call that knowledge. And so instead of saying I can never know reality itself, therefore I am a skeptic, Kant says, well, I can never know reality itself, but that was never possible to begin with. So I'm going to take what I know about my experience, and that's going to be my standard for knowledge. I'll call that knowledge. And that's going to be good enough. And so that's sort of Kant's, the Copernican revolution. Let's raise the... Maybe you have any idea what that means from Kant? Calls his own view. You know, he's a very humble man. He called his views the Copernican revolution in philosophy.
He's alluding to Copernicus and the him proposing the idea that we live in a solar system, not the center of the universe.
Yeah, so people used to think that the Earth was the center of the universe, and Copernicus was the first person to sort of push this idea that the or in a big way anyway, that the Earth revolved around the Sun along with the other planets, and it was a solar system with the Sun in the center, and that the Earth wasn't the center of the universe. And so that was a big change in
I mean, it was still flawed because he didn't realize that they were doing ellipses. He thought they were doing circles.
Right. Yeah, so he didn't have the whole picture. But at least he's the one who realized that the Earth spins like a top and revolves its axis as it moves around the Sun. And that's why it might look like the Earth's stationary and the Sun and the planets revolve around it. And so that just made a whole bunch of changes. So this idea that, you know, the Sun is just one among many stars in the galaxies and and the galaxy, and there's many galaxies, that there's nothing special about the Earth, it's not the center of the universe, that it's, you know, the third planet revolving around the sun, that man, you know, isn't as special as we thought he was. So there's a whole, that the church couldn't be trusted to do science. So, I mean, a whole bunch of things follow from that. And this is like at the cusp of the scientific revolution, and it brought a huge, a sea change. And so in the same way, he says, I'm doing that. And you, in retrospect, you might say, yeah, it's like all this bad stuff happened, the three H's and Karl Marx and all this sort of crazy relativism stuff. But I think another way of looking at Kant is seeing that he sort of overturned this idea of that, yeah, you can pierce the veil of appearance and get to reality itself. And that we need to be sophisticated in the way we think about how we perceive the world. That direct realism really is naive realism. So maybe that would be a more positive spin on him.
Karl Marx.
Let's see. Comments or questions? How about criticisms? So do we really need to go down this route? Can't we just say, well, sure, we have to perceive the world through sensation, but we know things about the objective world through our senses. Let's take this cup here now. So the cup is purple. Now, by purple, I mean that, you know, human beings get purple sensations by it. So maybe this example would sort of fit with Kant. Kant would say, look, see, the cup's not really purple. It's just that you experience it as purple. And there's nothing right. He would say there's nothing wrong with that. And if you understand the way light works and so on, then, you know, it makes sense. But wouldn't you say that, you know, what are you going to say about the, what does it mean to say that I'm trying to frame this question the right way. So, is Kant trying to be too fancy about it? You know, is he trying to say, well, you're not really seeing the purple cup, but there's something out there in the world which is causing you to have the experience of the purple cup that you can never know? Why I suppose that's true. Yeah.
Can I not directly answer that?
No, it's you can ask completely different.
I've just kind of been like sitting here thinking about it, and I mean, initially when I was thinking about just representationalism in general, it kind of seemed a little moot to me. Just kind of like, okay, there's a purple cup, and you're seeing a purple cup in your mind, but you're not actually looking right at the cup because it's only your perception of it. And that just kind of seemed moot because you're looking at what is reality, you're just not actually looking at it. But, I mean, when you kind of think of it a little further, I mean, what is, just kind of, you know, you didn't, like, the whole argument, you don't really know if what you're seeing is the way it actually is. And, like kind of like the way you said with the bad sonar, and then it just kind of gets me thinking, like, well, who, I mean, if all of us as humans see a purple cup, what makes, whose perception is correct? You know, if there's a God, is it God's perception is correct? Or is it, you know, I mean, if we don't have the right perception, then who does? You know, that kind of gets me to that question. I don't want to say that art, just because we all perceive it makes it right, but I mean, I guess I don't know what other scenario there would be.
Does there need to be a right perception?
Exactly, yeah. Does there?
Well, I guess people wonder about whether when they perceive things, whether they're perceiving reality or whether they're perceiving something that's an illusion.
But then what exactly would be reality? You know, I mean, let's say every organism on the planet perceived it as a purple cup.
Mm-hmm.
What? I don't know, wouldn't that kind of be our reality, almost?
Well, no, this goes back to the relativist thing, though, right? That if everyone believes that, therefore, it's our reality or it's true.
Yeah, and I don't want to argue that. I guess I don't know exactly how to put it.
But that's a sort of you can see how that's sort of a natural turn where you like go from, well, there's no way to know, therefore, let's just stick with what we got. And then let's just tip with what we got. It seems it degenerates into, well, that theory is as good as any other, which is, you know, the favorite refrain of Art Bell and his show that talked about crazy conspiracies and UFOs and aliens and stuff like that. And he'd always say, "Oh, a theory is as good as any other," and this idea that all ideas are equal. Yeah, Patrick.
I think Kant's kind of like a deranged opportunist, using science against like common people during the time, you know, because the laws of like wavelengths, like, you know, using science, he said, oh, well, you're just receiving, you know, the light source bouncing off the light, the cup, and then it's, you're perceiving it as purple, but aren't there like proven laws in science that is. Yes, you are seeing a purple cup because of this. But he's talking about you're not really seeing a purple cup.
Well, we came up with those laws, though, from our...
You assign the color purple sense of that sensation of when we see that with our eyes is what it's given. Other, like the deer walked up and saw that, he might not see it as purple. He sees it as whatever he represents that color in his mind. And that's what it's given. It's not that it's a different color, it's the perception of the color is different.
And we think because of the physiology that like animals have similar color perception, but that's not necessary. That's not necessary. But I see what you mean about is he overly complicating things, or is he saying that he's saying I want to save science from David Hume, because David Hume says we can never know anything, and there's no such thing as cause and effect. And with his view, science isn't even possible. Yeah.
I actually have two questions. So Kant, how would he go about justifying a truth to qualify it as knowledge? I mean, it's piercing the veil, like you said, but, I mean, is there a systematic way? I mean, where do we set the bar on that? Does he have an answer?
He says, in one place he says, before everybody wanted to try to find out whether our ideas conform to the world. But what we need to do now is let's try to get the world to conform to our ideas. So the idea is, what would reality have to be like for me to experience it this way? So he loves this word, presupposition.
It's like reverse engineering reality. Way of experience it.
Yes. Well, we know that science works. What would have to be true for science to work? We know that we have a mind. What would have to be true for us to have a mind? Or we know that learning is possible. What would have to be true for learning to be possible? We'd have to have a unitary consciousness with these different faculties and a thinking subject, not just a bunch of ideas bouncing around. Why do we perceive cause and effect? Well, it's because there has to be something like that out there. But we can't prove it through empiricism, the junk empiricism that's wrong. So he wants to save scientific knowledge from philosophical skepticism. And he thinks we do that, again, by lowering the bar. It's like, you know, women in the military, right? You want to have women in the military, and the requirement is you got to do 50 chin-ups, and most women can barely do 10, then, you know, lower the bar, right? 10 chin-ups is good enough. And, you know, we're going to send you over to die in Libya in the next war, or what have you. Syria. Wherever the next war is going to be. So the idea is that instead of trying to ascend to lofty heights and understand reality itself, recognize that that's impossible. So what you need to do is set your sights a little lower. You might see this as a philosophy of lowered expectations too.
Okay.
lowered expectations. So just don't think you never know reality itself. That's impossible. It's impossible by definition too, because to know reality in itself is to know reality unperceived, unconceived, because to perceive requires perception, perceptual equipment. Perceptual equipment necessarily does something to the same perceived. It perceives that thing in a certain way. And there's a whole bunch of different ways to perceive a thing, all of which are going to give you different sets of sensations.
But it could be the right way.
But what would the right way be? Like, now I suppose, so suppose you have like a box, right? And then you have a bat. That's it. And he sent me that, actually, this sound waves. Oh, okay. And so the sound waves, he's, you know, making the squeaky sound, and it's bouncing off, and he gets the idea of the box in his head. And suppose you're, like, looking at the box, and there's some kind of light source maybe here, so it's bouncing off here. That's more like it. So then the question is, who's perceiving the box correctly?
I don't know, but I'm saying that the possibility that there is a correct way and that one of them could be seeing it correctly is completely possible.
Although they're interpreting it through different waves, so it is an interpretation. Uh-huh. They're not seeing anything directly. So we couldn't say that either of them are correct, because it is an interpretation.
But just because it's an interpretation doesn't mean it's necessarily wrong.
Well, it means it's translated through two different means, and we're not actually getting the direct source. Like, to perceive necessarily means to translate.
Uh-huh.
Because to perceive, you need some kind of wave, sound, light.
Right.
Well, I can perceive. I don't know if this would be a good example, but I could perceive what a television show is, which is a perception of a person, but it's the exact same person that I would see in real life.
Yeah, I mean, you make a good point. I mean, this sounds similar. It's the same objective shape and size. It seems like those things are objective. Going back to Locke. Did I steal your thunder, or do you have a different point?
No, I kind of had a different question.
Let me just put, like, think about the shape and size of this box. They're just being perceived in different ways, but these two beings are getting the same information.
Yeah.
Different set of sensation, but the same truth, that there's an object of such and such a size. And if this bat was like a, you know, had human level intelligence, him and the human might be able to get together and say, well, oh, and suppose like the bat is really blind. The highly intelligent bat could say, oh yeah, well there's a box that's about 3 feet by, you know, 2 feet and so on. And the person with sight could agree that that's the case. And it might even be that if you have a sonar, you get some kind of weird resonant qualities, like the sound waves some bounce off different ways. And you might get something that's similar to color, but it's like has to do with sound. You know, you might get like subtle differences in the timbre or the resonance or whatever when you bounce off an object. So you might get a secondary quality like that. But it would be different. But it'd just be like, so you would be, you know, sound secondary quality blind, and the bat might be color blind. So you're getting different qualities of the object. Now, I suppose there, it makes it seem like, you know, it makes you, when you think about that possibility, it makes you think, oh, color's not really real. But that doesn't mean that the shape and size aren't. So maybe you can stick with, again, like the primary qualities. Maybe, why aren't those real? Why are those part of the world that's beyond us? That seems kind of weird to say that this box isn't really shaped as a cube, it doesn't really have such and such dimension, it doesn't exist in time and space. Yeah.
And they both be right and both be wrong?
So no one's there. I would say no. I would say, like, if there's a certain proposition, it's either true or false. And if one person asserts it and the other person doesn't, one of them has to be right.
But they're both
right because they're perceiving the box.
Right.
Yeah.
But they're both wrong because they are perceiving it differently than.
I think it depends
only if they think that the color is as real as the shape.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It reminds me of math when there's one right answer but there's two ways to get there.
Uh huh.
I think it would depend on if there is, like what I was trying to say before. I mean, there's no way we can know if there is one right answer, but hypothetically, if there is, just this one truth, I mean, there would have to be a one truth for them to be right or wrong. If there isn't, if it's the relativist, then yes, they would both be right and both be wrong. But if you're going to not assume the relativist, then technically one would be right and the other would be wrong.
You could think about Kant's skepticism in the following way. Think about how many objects are there in this room? There can be like a ballpark guess in that.
Thousands.
Thousands, okay. Anybody fewer?
156.
Yeah,
1,200.
Are we counting all the objects inside of our bags, or just what we can look at? I would say thousands.
Right. How many objects is this?
It's
a composite object.
It's also a fluid.
About like the tip here? I could pull that out if I pulled really hard and got my fingers all black.
It's too much.
There's also a little tube that holds the ink.
And there's all these little like things in the back here. Are they part of the object or not?
Those are sub-objects.
They're part of the...
It's a composite object.
They're part of the shell.
Right. So you think about like what counts as an object is somehow... Well, it's sort of somewhat arbitrary.
Yeah.
All right, no side conversations. Direct Matt.
Sorry.
Direct comments to the front. Did you want to share something, or what were you debating?
We're arguing.
Okay.
Good discussion.
No, I forgot what we were arguing about.
Objects.
So how many objects are there in the room? Well, there's not really an answer to that, because how you break up the world into how many objects is sort of an arbitrary thing. Whether you count this as one object or two objects or 10 objects, it's just a matter of where you want to draw the lines. And there's sort of natural ways that human beings draw the lines, and that's based on our evolution, the way our brains sort of organize information. But it's not as if that represents reality. That's an accident of evolution. Or I suppose, Kant was a pietist, so he might say it's divine design. But he would say that design still, doesn't necessarily represent the world the way it is. It just gives human beings the information they need to live and get along in the world that God created. It's not as if it represents the world as it is in itself. So think about also this concept of that's this idea of quantity. How about the concept of substance? Come back to that. Substance and quality. So we think about like the world as being made up of objects and their qualities. So we think, okay, here's an object. It is the cup. What are its qualities? It's purple, it's cylindrical, it's made of plastic. And that's the way our mind categorizes the world. But Kant asks, is that the way the world really is? Are there really substances out there in the world? Are there really separate objects?
Did anyone ever hit him with anything?
I come back to objections to Barclay, I guess, right? Throw something at him. Throw a rock at Barclay and see if he does. What if you thought about this thing, like the world is being made up of processes? Think about instead of an object. What if we thought about this cup as being made up of like a process of the molecules doing something? So you think about like a river, right? We tend to think about a river as an object,
even though it's not really an object, right? What a river is just a channel in the earth with water flowing through. But we tend to think about a river as a thing, right? We use a noun to describe it. Oh, the Willamette River. We don't say the process of water flowing through that the channel of the earth, you know, in the Willamette area. That's sort of how we think about it. And then our language is based on nouns and identifying objects. And then once we have identified an object, we describe it with adjectives. And that's thinking about things in terms of a substance and its qualities. And so, but is that the way the world really is? And you might describe the world in terms of processes and think about objects as being like the river, right? And it might make a certain amount of sense, right? If you think about molecules are sort of moving around and they're related in certain ways, and it's those molecular bonds which create objects. And if you can conceive of that as a process, I think Kant would say that thinking about objects as processes isn't any more or less true. It's just another way of conceiving them. But reality isn't that it's all processes, and it isn't that it's all substance and qualities. It's something that we can't conceive of. Yeah?
Can I shift gears and ask a question about Kant's view on mathematics?
Sure.
I just want to see if I'm understanding this right. Is he saying that mathematics are synthetic rather than analytic because each individual deducts the mathematics differently, even though they arrive at the same answer?
No.
Okay.
So this goes back to the distinction between the analytic and the synthetic. Synthetic. So an analytic truth is one where the predicate's contained in the subject. So like a bachelor is an unmarried male. If you know what a bachelor is, you know the predicate is an unmarried male applies to it. And you're really just sort of unpacking the subject. So a triangle has three sides. This also is analytic. A synthetic truth is a truth about a thing. It's not part of its definition, and it's not hidden in the subject. It's not contained in the predicate's not contained in the subject. So if I say, John is a bachelor, right? So you think about John the person. You know, John is a human being. That would be analytic. John is a man. Maybe that would be analytic. But John as a person is analytic. But saying John is a bachelor isn't about John's essence. It's just something that's true about him. And so that would be synthetic. Because you can't think of the concept of your friend John and think about, oh, is he married or not? You think about the concept of John-ness. John, he's like a funny guy. He plays a piano, you know, and you're thinking he's a human being. He's got two eyes and a nose and a mouth. Is he married? And you can't just think about the concept of your friend and know he's married.
It's a description, basically.
Right, and it's something that you'd have to find out by doing some investigation with your senses. So the predicate's not contained in the subject. It's like there are Masonic symbols on the dollar bill. That's synthetic because you can't think of the symbol of a dollar, which is, you know, a unit of currency, and know whether it has Masonic symbols on it. You have to like look at it, and then you have to do some research to find out about which symbols come from the Masons. So coming back to mathematics, the reason mathematics is synthetic is because when you have a mathematical sentence, the predicate's not contained in the subject. So Kant thinks about a sentence as like a mathematical equation, like a sentence. So like 7 is 4 plus 3. So here's the predicate 7. The subject 7. And the predicate is 4 plus 3. And is this contained in this? Well, Kant would say it's true that those two things seem to agree, but there has to just be one there can't be more than one predicate contained in the subject. There's an infinite number of predicates that can be you know, seen in the number 7.
It's like 1 plus 6.
Yeah. So because Kant says there's an infinite number, or, you know, 49 divided by 7 or what have you, because there's an infinite number of predicates, you can't say it's really contained in the subject. So he thinks there has to be some sort of definite amount. You can't think of all. So these are just facts about the number 7, that if you take 49 divided by 7, you get 7. It's a fact about 7. It's not part of the essence of 7, that if you add 6 and 1, you get it. That's not part of the definition of 7.
And that's why he puts definitions still in analytic, but mathematics is synthetic.
Right.
The infinite number of predicates.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So when going on from Hume, Kant says it's not just a priori, a posteriori, and relations of ideas and matters of fact, that the two don't match up the way Hume thought. Hume thought if it's about concepts, then it's a relation of ideas. So if it's about mathematics, Kant says that's about ideas and about whether they agree or disagree. 2 and 2 is 4, the ideas agree, you sort of think about the concept of two-ness and of addition and two-ness and four-ness, and you look in your peer inside your mind's eye and you say, okay, that's a true statement, 2 and 2 is 4. But if it's a matter of fact in existence, then it's going to be not a priori, but a posteriori. And you have to use your senses, you have to look out in the world. And so, and Hume says you can never know matters of fact and existence a priori, and you can never know about the relations of ideas or about concepts a posteriori. And what Kant says is that's not quite true. We can know some facts about the world a priori. We can know some facts about the world a priori. Now, not quite as many as Descartes thinks, but there's a few basic things. And that's, so he has this category, the synthetic a priori.
Yeah.
And the synthetic a priori are these things which aren't just like trivial things like a bachelor's, a married male, or an unmarried male, or a triangle has three sides, but they're significant truths about the world that we know through pure reason, apart from sensation. And this is what makes Kant sort of partly a rationalist. And he would say something like, there is an objective world, is something that you can't prove with your senses, but you know through reason. So, there is an objective world. Kant thinks you just sort of have an intuition that this is true. It's like 2 and 2 is 4. You know there's a world independent of your mind. You can't prove it with the senses, and that's why empiricism is a bankrupt philosophy. And you shouldn't try to restrict yourself to your senses, because you end up with an absurdity like Berkeley's or Hume's views. And so he says, you're commonsensically, there is an objective world. You can't prove it through the senses, so you must know it through reason. So that's one thing you know through, that's part of the synthetic a priori. Also, this idea of cause and effect. He says Hume's right. You can't prove cause and effect through observation. All observation will show you is that's the way it's always happened in the past. Therefore, but how do you know it's going to happen in the future? So Kant says, but you can't prove cause and effect with the senses, but you know there's got to be something like cause and effect out there in the world to explain the regularity of nature and that makes science possible. Therefore, you assume there is such thing as cause and effect. Yeah?
I don't know if this is kind of a silly question, but when trying to, like, notice the difference between empiricism and rationalism, it kind of seems like just personally, you literally cannot, without your senses, I mean, that's how you perceive the world, that's how you gain information. Without that, there's literally no way to make any rational decision about anything. I mean, you can't gather information and then make a decision about it without first gathering the information, it seems like. It doesn't seem that rationalism is possible without empiricism.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the empiricist critique of rationalism.
Is that Kant's view, basically?
I think Kant.
You need both.
Kant says you sort of need insights from both. You need a certain amount of a priori knowledge, but a priori knowledge only takes you so far. It gives you first principles, and then you generally use your senses to figure out the world. But you have to start out with these sort of first principles of logic and mathematics and some basic philosophical axioms or premises, like there's an objective world. There's such a thing as cause and effect. I mean, those two basic things. The world is pretty much the same everywhere. That's homogeneous. Those are like sort of the basic presuppositions of science. So if you think about, like, if there's some anomalous event, and a scientist if you have the scientists like, suppose, I'm trying to think of something that would be anomalous. Suppose there's like a person, we verified the person's lived like 150 years long. So the guy's 150 years old. And the scientists are puzzling over this. They've verified his birth records. They have like photographs going back, you know, to when he was a baby, all sorts of historical records. This guy's 150 years old. And you have some scientists trying to figure out, well, what's going on with this guy? Because the Hayflick limit says your DNA can only replicate so many times. And 120 years is about the outset for maximum human lifespan. And so one person might say, well, maybe he's got something funny about his genes. Maybe his telomeres are extra long. Somebody else might say, maybe it's his body has some way of cleaning out the junk DNA so he doesn't get as many errors in his DNA as he moves along through life. And then suppose a third person would say, well, maybe he just lives extra long. And they think, what do you mean by it? What's your hypothesis? Oh, it's no reason. He just like lives a long time. It's just the way he is, right? So that's an unscientific attitude, because science presupposes causes, and science is about delving into causes and finding out the why of something, and it presupposes a world of cause and effect. So it's not as if philosophy has to prove there is such thing as cause and effect. You sort of go the other way around. You say, look, we do science to find out about the world. How do we find out about the world? We delve into what events cause what other events. And that's sort of what science is. It's looking into causes. Science presupposes that cause and effect exists. So you can't prove cause and effect. You have to assume it. And the world doesn't make any sense if you don't assume it. So that's a rationalist sort of idea, that you have an a priori intuition that there is such a thing as cause and effect. And once you assume that's true, then you can investigate the world using a generally empirical method. You can use your senses, you can use observations, you get out your microscopes and your telescopes and do a bunch of studies, and you're using your senses. But you can't do that unless first you posit the idea that there is cause and effect, and you go out looking for the causes. Why don't we end a little early today, and we'll continue on with Kant and review for the second midterm on Wednesday.